You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
Beijing.
Beijing wins the 2022 Winter Olympics, but what does it tell us that there weren't enough contestants to warrant the award of a bronze medal? My guests Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Quentin Peel will examine this and the day's other top stories, including a look at the ongoing corruption scandal engulfing Brazil and Venezuela's attempts to reignite a border dispute with Guyana, a consideration of the leadership contests come existential crises currently being played out by the Republican Party in the US and the Labour Party here in Britain, and another busy week for the Russian Air Force and the NATO pilots who scramble in response to it. Where is Moscow going with this? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the program. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University here in London, and Quentin Peel, Senior Fellow with the Europe Program at Chatham House. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the dubious triumph of Beijing, which has today been confirmed as the host of the 2022 Winter Olympic Games, besting a field which consisted in its entirety of Kazakhstan's former capital, Almaty. Beijing is in many respects an unideal host, the capital of a country whose human rights record is not improved notably since it controversially hosted the Summer Games in 2008, and where you can't breathe the air and where it doesn't snow. Quentin, is this as bad for the Olympic movement as I've just made it sound?
It isn't great. I think it's a disappointment too, in a way, between those two. Almaty might have been more fun, and it has some real snow.
Well, exactly, yes. Which you would think would be a consideration. I mean, I guess what I'm asking is to stick with you, Quentin, is the idea of a Winter Games taking place on artificial snow just an irresistible metaphor for something?
It is pretty odd. It is really bending every idea, and it makes the whole thing so artificial. But the tragedy for them was that actually, you know, Oslo pulled out, Munich pulled out, Samoitz pulled out in Switzerland, because ordinary people, if they're given a choice, probably don't want to have it. It's governments that want it to as great aggrandizement, and I fear a lot of corruption. So when we saw the Russian Winter Olympics at Sochi, I mean, they spent about $50 billion. And there's no doubt a hell of a lot of that went missing.
It is extraordinary, and I suspect that is what put a lot of people off. But, Oscar, as Quentin points out, a lot of places initially bid vaguely for this or thought about it, then decided they didn't want it. The complete roll call of no-shows, I think I'm right in saying, is Oslo, Stockholm, Lviv, Munich and San Moritz. In Munich and San Moritz in particular, they were defeated by referendum. The actual voters of both places just went not here. What is it about the Olympics, and I guess you could probably extend that now to World Cup, that democratic countries are just thinking, we can watch this on television.
Well, witness what happened in Brazil. We'll talk more about Brazil later on.
Indeed,
but,
so.
But, you know, many of the protests there in the previous years had to do with the fact that all this money had been spent in infrastructure that nobody needed and nobody were going to use.
I mean, is that a problem, Quentin, that when voters, people who get a say in what their government spend their money on, look around where they live, you can generally identify priorities beyond putting on a global spectacle of dubious lasting value?
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. And the Winter Olympics is such a relatively artificial thing. I mean, at least perhaps for the World Cup or for the ordinary Olympics, you're building stadiums that can be used for quite a lot of other stuff. But, you know, ski runs and so on, that's all pretty artificial. But then the trouble is, and I know the International Olympic Committee is supposed to have cleaned up its act a fair bit, but did you see the sort of stuff they were asking for? For example, why Oslo pulled
this is
out.
Why Oslo pulled mm-hmm. its plug.
Mean, they were wanted free telephones, and they wanted a reception with the king, and they wanted to be treated like royalty, all the members of the committee, wherever they went. And finally, the Norwegians said, stuff this, we just don't want to do it.
You know, we see it even in the Summer Olympics. Many people did ask why, as UN enter the Olympic Village, you could only spend with your certain credit card and so on and so forth. That creates a bit of a contradiction. My prediction is that the next Winter Olympics will take place in Dubai. they have an artificial.
Yeah, don't joke about these things. You know, like 5 or 6 years ago, it would have seemed pretty funny the idea of the World Cup occurring in Qatar.
Cool.
And apparently that's actually going to go on. I mean, it's an observation that's been made many times elsewhere, but is the problem now that the IOC and FIFA, and I guess one or two similar organisations, they're effectively just borderless roaming tyrannies, aren't they?
And I think there's far too much money about that it's actually from all the television contracts and everything, that it just makes it too tempting to go for the really big deal where people get a lot of kickbacks.
I mean, do we have to, just a final thought on this one, Oscar, before we move on, do we have to resign ourselves to the likelihood that future Olympic Games are just basically going to take place in places like, you know, I don't know, Pyongyang or Moscow or Dubai or Bahrain, or because have they just become incompatible with open societies?
Well, unless our representatives do something to bring the mafias in FIFA and the Olympic organization down, we will see these along.
And there was a very good suggestion that we should actually have the Olympic Games every year, every time they came up, in Greece. Now, the only problem was having the Olympic Games in Athens practically bankrupted Greece, one of the big reasons Greece is in such a mess. But actually, if everybody else paid for it, it might actually give the Greeks a bit of income.
Actually, they just came with a good solution there for two problems.
Okay, well, first problem solved. Let's have a whack at South American corruption and see if we can fix that before the break. We'll take a look at a couple of stories. The first up is the latest on those corruption scandals which are currently engulfing Brazilian politics. Recent developments include the laying of charges against Marcelo Odebrecht, who is president of the immense construction corporation which bears his family's name. And investigations are also continuing into Brazil's state electricity firm Eletrobras. Oscar, I'll ask you first, for the benefit of listeners who may not have been keeping up with this, how big a deal is this? And to what extent, I guess, are the ripples from it going to start affecting Brazilian politics? Because Dilma Rousseff is in real trouble here, isn't she?
Oh, she is. Her popularity levels have plunged to something close to 13%. And the party she represents, the Workers' Party, is in deep trouble. Because its supporters are disheartened by the fact that a party of the left, which allegedly has a higher ethical call, has engaged in the same corruption games which have historically ridden Brazilian politics. Now, this is not a new issue. I have with me a 2012 article by Leonardo Boff, the well-known theologian and philosopher about corruption, explaining that corruption has historical roots in Brazil. The so-called Jeitinho, the Brazilian trickster way of doing things, has roots in colonization, nepotism, and dictatorship. But the problem now is that we have a party that is supposed to uproot those evils and has fell into temptation. That's a huge problem. The other problem is, but this is the other side of the story, the story that we have with us now, is the story of these big families, the ones who have treated the public realm as if it were the private realm, the Odebrechts and others. And maybe this is the only good news that we can gather from this mess, the fact that those who treated the country as if it were their own are now in trouble.
Quentin, aside from the obvious problem here, which is the corruption being investigated, how damaging is this to Brazil in the wider world? Because Brazil in particular and South America in general, over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a real perception that they have overcome the decades of military dictatorship and general sort of poor government and poverty, that they were taking their places on the world stage. And with all due acknowledgement that corruption is a worldwide problem, this is some fairly old school stuff being suggested here.
It is, and it is a tragedy for Brazil, because really I think there was great hopes that Brazil was finally no longer always going to be a country with its future ahead of it. It was going to actually make it. And when President Lula Lula was president, very popular. He seemed to be pressing all the right buttons. He seemed to be able to actually make stuff work. And suddenly the old corruption's coming back and coming to haunt us. But I think the real danger for Brazil at the moment is that this ever-widening scandal is really bringing the economy to a halt when it was already slowing down dramatically.
Worst recession for 25 years,
absolutely.
In fact.
And when you get a situation where every company that now gets involved in this is forbidden from bidding any more for contracts until it's all sorted out, so they're not getting on with jobs, they're laying people off, everything's falling back, and the government, torn apart by the different allegations of corruption, is also getting more and more indecisive. So hence, that's why Brazil is, I think, in real danger of having its sovereign bond status downgraded to junk.
Oscar, you spoke there of a feeling among Brazilians of being disheartened that these sort of shenanigans could have been occurring in the Workers' Party, which, as you said, under Rousseff a while ago, and certainly under Lula, had been very popular and perceived as this kind of great engine of social and economic progress. Are people genuinely scandalized? Because one of two things tends to happen, I think, anywhere in the world when a corruption story breaks. Either people are genuinely shocked, or it just kind of confirms what they pretty much suspected was going on anyway. Which of those is this?
I think it's more the former, even though Brazilians will tell you that this has been going on for a long time.
You think there is like genuine shock attending this?
Yes, precisely because they expected and they demanded of the Workers' Party not to engage in this sort of shenanigans. The important, you know, something important to understand here is the fact that unless what it happens in other countries, I'm thinking of the scandal of AB Systems bribing Saudi officials, and the judicial inquiry was stopped here in Britain. Well, they're going forward with the investigation in Brazil. So at least let's give them credit for that. It is problematic because, as Quentin said before, it is beginning to affect the economy. But at the same time, what is more problematic for the Workers' Party is that it needs to reconstruct itself. It needs to go back to its basis in the social movements. That's what grassroots Brazilians are asking for. Hence the very low popularity, and that low popularity tells you that they are genuinely shocked.
But the trouble is, this corruption is so in your face. It's so blatant. I mean, I see they raided the home of a former president, Fernando Collor, the other day, and they took away his Porsche, his Lamborghini, and his Ferrari.
He clearly just saved his public sector wages extremely carefully.
And then one of the other guys they picked up, apparently, the prosecutor said, oh, poor fellow, he actually got mugged on his way to the Petrobras offices when he was going to meet somebody, and he lost 100,000 reals on the way.
Yeah, the question there is who was the real thief? But again, you know, part of the problem here, what this reveals is the huge inequalities here. There is still this convention, this behavior that you have to get as much money as you can, you have to show it, you have to spend it. That kind of culture has to come to an end. That's part of the challenge that Brazil is facing now.
Okay, well, staying in South America, we should also look briefly at what appears to be an escalation, a possibly deliberate one, of an ancient border dispute between Venezuela and Guyana. I mean, for me, this is pretty exciting. I do like a good arcane diplomatic fracas, and this ticks every box. President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela this week visited the UN to press his country's claims upon territory, including waters off Guyana's almost certainly about to be mispronounced Essequibo coast, a cause possibly not unconnected with Exxon's recent discovery of oil in the general vicinity. Oscar, the obvious question, I guess, is this really a thing, or is this just Maduro searching for another nationalist rallying point as his popularity ratings continue to head towards the Earth's core?
To be truthful, this conflict pre-existed Maduro. You know, it goes back to the 19th century. Several Venezuelan presidents denounced the treaty that took place there, because the treaty was actually signed between the United States and Britain. The U.S. was representing Venezuela because the British would not speak to the Venezuelans. You know, these are the old days of gunboat diplomacy. Why did I say, the old days. they seem to be coming back. So this is a very old nut. But of course, it's coming back at a time in which to enhance and provoke more nationalistic feelings, thus have a certain political capital within Venezuela. I don't think this is going to go, to become too problematic. This is in the hands of the United Nations. The issue is oil, as usual. There may be some oil in the border, and that's what they're after.
But isn't the issue also that Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, is really actually on the back foot, and he needs issues to whip up a bit of local support, well, because he's really going down the tubes.
Let's remember that he's fighting an electoral campaign. They call for elections in November. We're going to see whether or not the party he represents is on the back foot. It is also the case that the opposition remains divided and has been unable to really hurt the government. So, of course, here, as usual, both politics and economics and genuine concerns do get mixed up.
And Venezuela, in contrast to Brazil, my God, the economy shrinking by 7% and inflation running at 150%. They're in big trouble.
Indeed, they are. Final thought on this one from Oscar. Maduro, and I can't pass this up, has been thundering about what he describes as Guyanese provocations. Do we have any idea like what?
Not really. But let us remember that, yes, the economy is shrinking. There is also here an issue of internal politics. Last week, a big container with loads of foodstuffs being hoarded by supermarkets was discovered. So part of the problem here has to do with politics.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Quentin Peel. Coming up next, leadership crises on opposite sides of politics on opposite sides of the Atlantic, and the Russian Air Force's continuing joyrides in international airspace.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Singapore, our bureau chief is Nolan Giles.
I think the most exciting thing about being based here in Singapore during this period of such rapid growth for Southeast Asia is the energy of the professional community here. So you have this Singaporean mindset of ambition and of hard work and of punching well above its weight, mixed with a community of people from outside the country that have come here to add more depth, to bring their knowledge, to bring their culture and their understanding.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And you're welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Quentin Peel. Now, whatever one's political sympathies, the spectacle of a political party self-destructing is always a compelling one, and aficionados of such drama can currently enjoy rich pickings on both sides of the Atlantic. In the United States, the party of Lincoln, Grant, Theodore Roosevelt, and Eisenhower has contrived a leadership contest in which Donald Trump is only about the sixth silliest candidate. In the UK, the bookies favourite to be the next leader of the Labour Party is an old-school left-winger who it is desperately difficult to imagine ever receiving a single vote outside the Democratic People's Republic of Islington North. Quentin, I'll ask you first. We'll talk about the GOP first. I can remember in 2012, everybody saying that surely now the Republican Party has learnt that there is no future whatsoever in being the party of angry middle-aged white men in the United States. They haven't learnt, have they?
They haven't, and they are really tearing themselves apart. It's, I suppose, partly because it is wide open and there is no obvious candidate of the middle who's coming up. Jeb Bush might have been, but he's awfully damaged by the fact that George W. really...
It is amazing, as he's literally campaigning as Jeb.
Yeah.
Yes. The word Bush does not, is Bush. Not appearing on his literature.
Yeah. And because I think we were expecting right at the beginning that it was going to be another Clinton versus Bush. But really, the fact that the Republican Party is scared of the, or scared of the Tea Party group, going along with fundamentalists, going along with passionate libertarians, and they're all picking up support. And then you've got Donald Trump, who really is just depressingly off the radar. He seems to be picking up votes.
It strikes me, or at least my own potted theory, is that there's a collective madness at work in both parties, and it affects organizations as well as individuals. When you make a massive misjudgment of something, and rather actually accept reality, you double down on your original stance. It's like getting dumped by someone and then proposing marriage to them. And in the same way that there's a huge amount of people in the Labour Party appear convinced that the reason they got beaten in May, and they got beaten badly in May, they got absolutely walloped, is that they weren't left-wing enough. Just as there are Republicans who seem to believe we must be further right-wing, and then the people will come to us. Is this just a cycle in the life of political parties, Oscar? It's the other side of the pendulum swing from Reagan winning 49 states in 84 or the Blair landslide here in 97. Is it just cyclical?
No, this is not a cycle. Something else is happening both here and in the US. Perhaps this is global. I mean, we saw Syriza, we saw Podemos. But now, if you take a look at the cover of Time magazine this week, you will be told that not only in the Republican Party, but also in the Democratic Party, you have Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders also picking up a lot of people. Perhaps the best comparison to make is between Jeremy Corbyn and the Sanders-Warren phenomenon, since they seem to be speaking to the same kind of disaffected people, and they're talking up issues that do concern a lot of people. This has to do, obviously, with the political effects of the economic crisis. So I don't think we should dismiss this just as a cycle, crazy people going for it. Something like that is happening in the Republican Party in the United States. Of course, whether or not we like someone like Donald Trump, I don't like him at all. He began by bad-mouthing Latinos in the U.S., which is the worst thing you can do if you want to be a president of the U.S., given our demographics there. Anyhow, he is using this kind of frank language that some people react to. And this is not going to go away as easily as we would like to.
But the people who react to frank language, whether it's Donald Trump's right-wing populism or Jeremy Corbyn's sort of stances on the Middle East or on Trident, these are people who follow politics day in, day out, week in, week out. And that's not the majority of people who actually vote on election day. Quentin, what do you think is going on with the Labour Party here? There is, of course, no law which decrees that a political party has to exist forever. I mean, is it possible that they have just run out of their natural Labour constituency, that the people who were Labour's bedrock for decade in, decade out just aren't there in enough numbers anymore?
I think there's a real danger of that for the Labour Party, because they've had this devastating defeat in Scotland. Let's not forget that's really where they were punished.
But who were they defeated by in Scotland?
By a party to the left of
exactly.
them. They were defeated by the Scottish Nationalist Party campaigning against austerity and saying Labour's gone too far to the middle. So they're
also campaigning massively on sentimental nationalism as well.
Absolutely. And in the end, I think you've got to recognise it was as much that won it for them. And it was also that Labour had got tired and actually rather corrupt, having been in office for too long. We're back to the old theme of corruption. And we're in a fascinating position now, I think, where everybody still knows you can't win power except in the middle ground. But there's a revolt against the middle ground right across the spectrum. People are fed up because they feel the middle ground's got us into this economic mess. The middle ground is boring and we want something more. My children are not very interested in traditional politics of the middle ground. They're tending to go for green options or other options rather than far left or far right. But nonetheless, they want an alternative. So I think everybody's looking for an alternative. But the Labour Party is actually, I think, going to commit suicide. If it does, I can't quite believe. Now, I come from the People's Republic of South Islington, so I'm pretty close to Jeremy Corbyn, and he's a lovely guy. But I just, as you said in the introduction, I cannot see him winning power. It just won't work.
A final thought and brief thought on this one from you, Oscar. I mean, even Jeremy Corbyn, in fairness, doesn't appear to think he can ever possibly be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Is there something to be said, as a lot of his supporters are suggesting, for basically having him as an agitating placeholder leader for 2 or 3 years to try and reframe the terms of political debate in this country before handing it over to somebody a bit more plausible, maybe 18 months, 2 years out?
In politics, you only have two alternatives. Either you win the game or you change the rules of the game. Perhaps what we are witnessing here, as Quentin said, is a lot of people, very young people, who are fed up with the rules of the game being always at the center. They're looking for something very different. Maybe they see it in Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, finally tonight, one might have been forgiven for thinking that Russia has lately calmed down a bit, given that Moscow has now managed to go nearly 18 months without invading any of its neighbours. However, its policy of testing the defences and, one suspects, the patience of the West persists. In the past week, jets from NATO's Baltic Air Policing Mission have intercepted 22 Russian jets, adding to a total of 250 emergency scrambles of NATO planes so far this year. Quentin, I rather suspect that this is all terrific fun for the pilots on both sides. Is it actually serious beyond that?
Well, I think the serious thing is that somebody could make a stupid mistake. Somebody could actually, you know, press the button or just get too close to another plane and you'd get two coming down.
Which we did see happen over China with a US aircraft in 2001, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think in a way that it's provocatia, as they'd say in Russian. Mm. It's a deliberate provocation, and it will play very well for Mr. Putin if something like that happened, actually. Say, hey, hang on, you know, we weren't doing anything about patrolling the grounds that we're supposed to be patrolling. It's a very dangerous game, and that's what worries me.
Oscar, is it possible, I mean, trying to place a limit on Moscow's cynicism would be an interesting exercise, but it's undisputed that a lot of these aircraft are also flying in international airspace with their transponders switched off, which means they can't be tracked by local radar. Is Putin at some level willfully risking the idea of some sort of accident or mishap that he can confect into a bigger crisis?
Well, he does want to appear as being the strong man. And this is a way of doing so before its Russian electorate. He wants to show both its Russian electorate and the rest of the world that Russia is still strong. And this kind of provocation, you know, specifically explained by that kind of attitude, which is, of course, quite dangerous.
And he wants to be back at the top table with the Americans. He actually doesn't care very much about his neighbours, the Europeans. He wants to be at the top table with the Americans and is demanding, pay attention to me.
But just to follow that thought up, and again, I'm asking you at this point to channel the internal psychodrama of Vladimir Putin, but who is not taking Russia seriously? I mean, it's a serious country. It's a big, powerful, important country. Everybody thinks so, don't they?
Yes, but what Quentin is saying is quite interesting. They do not want to keep dealing with Europe. They want to talk to America. They don't see Europe as its own, you know, the owner of its own destiny. They see America as the puppeteer.
And President Putin was mad as a rat that people didn't turn up in bigger numbers to his Winter Olympics in Sochi, to bring us back to the beginning. That was a big deal for him, and it was snubbed. He was snubbed by a lot of important people. He takes that very badly.
Is there any means of dissuading Russia from doing this, or is it just something that, you know, will have to be put up with?
I think that at one level, if people can get through to him that this is actually his deal was, allow me to be the autocrat and I will give you prosperity. The prosperity is fading away. And I think if people actually start to say, this is not a very good deal, people aren't investing here, then it might come through. And secondly, can we persuade him that a stable neighbourhood is better than an unstable neighbourhood? Up till now, he doesn't seem to think so.
Very final thought on this from Oscar. Is this basically the equivalent of Nicolas Maduro picking fights with Guyana over arcane border disputes? Is this Putin just seeking to create distractions?
Well, in the case of Venezuela, this is a dispute that can be solved by the United Nations, not the case in the Russia-EU-USA. Actually, there is an interesting article in this month's issue of The Atlantic with the title, The Cold War Never Ended.
Indeed not. We will have to leave it there. Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Quentin Peel, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all for today's episode, which was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Malcolm Charchoglian, and Paige Reynolds. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, music from Monocle's international playlist. At 1900 hours, Marcus Hippie is here with the menu. At 2200, I'm back with the Monocle Daily and Emma Nelson, I think I'm right in saying. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. For this edition, it's goodbye. Have a great weekend.